I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And they're off and running. With the conventions behind them, the candidates have set off on the final 60-day leg of the race that will take one of them to the White House. John McCain and Sarah Palin appear together in two key battleground states, Wisconsin and Michigan, today, while Barack Obama and Joe Biden will both be in Pennsylvania, but at separate appearances. With us is Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News and author of ABCNews.com's The Note. And Rick, your recap of the last 2 weeks is everything is different, everything is the same after the conventions. What do you mean by that?
Well, these 2 weeks have been incredibly busy. We've got two new running mates. We've got these two conventions. We've had really the last 14 days have been really remarkable. But we're still where we were before, which is to say we have an enormously tight race. By most accounts, Barack Obama up, but up by only a little bit. He got some bounce out of the convention. We expect that to be partly wiped out by the pick of Sarah Palin and the new energy on the Republican side, as well as the convention that we're just coming off of here in St. Paul. So it does seem like we are back where we were and where we've been really since the general election started in earnest in June.
Well, in fact, these conventions are choreographed to gain that post-convention bounce in support and interest. But a new CBS New York Times poll shows today that the race is evenly split at 42% for each ticket. And it seems like a lot of attention is focused on Sarah Palin right now. Which side do you think has the most momentum?
I think this was Palin's convention. This was the Sarah Palin convention. Republican delegates, Republican activists around the country are excited about her, really in a way that we haven't seen them become in a very long time. A lot of folks making the comparison saying, well, look, maybe we found our Barack Obama here, someone that can get us excited about voting Republican, going out there and working and start to close that enthusiasm gap that's existed. That's really been a big asset for Barack Obama. But with that comes a price. And the Sarah Palin that we've seen emerge has undergone a lot of scrutiny. She'll continue to do folks wondering exactly who she is and what she's about. I think all of that cuts possibly in a different direction. So I'm not sure that we know exactly how that plays out, but I do know there are a lot of Republicans more excited than they were a week ago.
Well, with the enthusiasm then on the Republican side because of Palin, as you say, what does the Obama campaign do to respond to that?
They've got to be careful about how they play this because they cannot be seen as going after her in an excessively over-the-top way because of the charges of sexism that have already emerged. They know exactly how to play this because they played it against Hillary Clinton before. They've got to go after her record to some degree and call into question her qualifications. They have to do it with a bit of a light touch. We're seeing them now turn to some female surrogates. Kathleen Sebelius, the governor of Kansas, also Hillary Clinton will be out there on the trail early next week in Florida. And I think the Obama folks feel like putting out female politicians who support Barack Obama is just a nice way to push back at any of the advantage that Sarah Palin may gain among women voters.
Well, one set of numbers that have moved during the last 2 weeks are the money numbers. The McCain campaign said it received $10 million in donations shortly after Sarah Palin was introduced. And the Obama camp said it raised $10 million after Palin's convention speech. What do you make of that?
It speaks louder than the polls in some ways. It tells you that she's enormously popular with the base. It tells you that a lot of people have turned off by her and feel like they have to do something else. I think we're seeing some of that, I think, as Democrats who are growing a little bit nervous about what's going on with Sarah Palin. I mean, just think about what's happened in the space of a week. She has gone from an unknown, obscure governor of a far-off state into someone that's become a national obsession. She's a huge celebrity right now, for better or for worse, maybe bold. So I feel like that gets Republicans excited. It also gets Democrats thinking, well, maybe we've got to kick in a little bit extra here to make sure that our guy survives this.
Well, if she's such a celebrity, where is she? You know, you look at the upcoming appearances. McCain and Palin are making joint appearances today. Obama and Biden are making separate ones. And we don't see Palin scheduled on any major news programs this weekend. Is that unusual?
Well, the other three will be Obama, Biden, McCain, all doing one of the big Sunday morning talk shows. Sarah Palin, you've got to think the campaign doesn't think she's ready yet. They're worried about some kind of a pop quiz on foreign leaders or on the major conflicts over there. Make sure you know the difference between Sunnis and Shiites. And imagine they're training right now with something akin to studying for Jeopardy. There's some talk in the McCain campaign this week about sending Sarah Palin back to Alaska. Of course, her son ships out to be deployed to Iraq September 11th. So it makes some sense for him for her to go back in advance of that. So I think they'll use this time, and they don't have much of it because there's only 60 days left. They'll use this time, though, to try to make her bone up, have her bone up on the big issues that are out there.
Rick Klein, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News and author of ABCNews.com's The Note. Well, looking back on these 2 weeks of convention speeches, how well did the candidates and their surrogates make their case?
I wasn't my own man. anymore. I was my country's.
About John McCain's speech last night, Time magazine columnist Joe Klein writes that in tone, it seemed more the end of a career than the beginning of a presidency. But former Reagan speechwriter Ken Kachigian said he shaped the presidency he'd have if he won. And while Rudy, Michelle, Hillary, and Joe's Biden and Lieberman had their moments, people are still talking about Sarah Palin's speech. Democrats are now saying it was all the work of Bush speechwriters. Well, two former presidential speechwriters join us now. Michael Waldman wrote for Bill Clinton. Michael is executive director of the Brennan Center for Justice. He joins us from the Argonne Network in New York City. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
And David Frum wrote for George W. Bush. He joins us from the studio of the American Enterprise Institute, where he is a resident fellow. Hi, David.
Hello.
Well, first, John McCain's speech. Conservative Wall Street Journal columnist Peggy Noonan raves about Palin today. And Noonan had two short sentences for John McCain. John McCain also made a speech. It was flat. What do you two make of McCain's speech? Michael Waldman first.
That is the word I used last night writing about it for Newsweek. Look, McCain has a commendable record in many respects and has a compelling story, but that speech in some ways was daring. This was a two-week period when the parties kind of reversed their normal roles. Democratic nominees for decades have gotten up and said, as my old boss Bill Clinton did in a variety of ways, I'm not like the other Democrats. Obama had to show that he was like the other Democrats, who right now are more popular than Republicans. McCain went and, in effect, tried to, as they say in politics, pull a sister soldier on his own convention, really giving a very strong condemnation of his own party. They wouldn't let the incumbent president speak, things like that. I just think that he didn't really go all the way with it. And the policy agenda was fairly standard issue Bush-era Republican policies and didn't show that McCain had somehow come up with a new reformist agenda.
David, what did you make of it?
I look at these two speeches of Barack Obama's and John McCain's and see two bad speeches, one well-delivered, one poorly delivered. John McCain's speech, it reminded me actually of the best anecdote in a book by my former colleague Karen Hughes. She's left the White House. She's walking on the beach, and she looks up and she sees one of those little planes pulling an advertising slogan behind it, and the slogan says something like, "Jill, come back. I am miserable without you. Love, Jack." And she thinks, "Bad message, Jack. Too much about you, not enough about her." That was the McCain problem. It's great to have all these people standing up and saying he's an incredible hero. He met the most extreme circumstance and he triumphed. This is exactly the leader you want in a crisis. And then it was his job to say, okay, I'm ready. I'll follow you. John, where are we going? And then he says, here's why you should follow me.
And
And
he was stiff. He was stiff.
I know why I'm following you. I want to know where. And he didn't tell me that. Obama had kind of the different opposite problem. He told everybody where he was taking them. It was just a place they didn't want to go. It was like back to the 70s in Walter Mondale.
David's right about – let me just say that if you look back at FDR, he did not give a speech that talked about polio and his overcoming polio. And John Kennedy didn't talk about PT-109. This isn't just a John McCain problem. All the politicians do this stuff lately, but it's a really bad trend.
Well, a New York Times headline today sums up where the Republicans find themselves, party in power running as if it weren't. Let's listen into these speeches, McCain and Barack Obama.
Let me just offer an advance warning to the old big spending, do nothing, me first, country second crowd. Change is coming.
You have shown what history teaches us. That at defining moments like this one, the change we need doesn't come from Washington. Change comes to Washington.
So over the past 2 weeks, who's won this mantle of change? David?
Well, I don't think either, really. I mean, that Barack Obama had this problem as he went to the convention to say, well, what are you for? Be specific. Hope, yes. Change, good. Like what? And we now hear, well, basically he envisions a much bigger state, that he has nothing to say about the Clinton achievement of the Clinton and Bob Rubin years when the Democratic Party did preside over considerable prosperity by leaving behind its statist instincts of the past. And now he's on the campaign trail talking about supporting the new Equal Pay Act that would jettison competitively market-set wages and have the government supervise every wage contract in the country with an arbitrary, whimsical, numerical scheme. I mean, it is not. I mean, I guess regression is a form of change. It's different, but it's not new.
Michael, do you think Obama is losing the grip on his change mantle?
No, I don't. Though he hasn't. He hasn't fully closed the deal with the public, though neither has McCain. I think that Obama had an interesting, slightly delicate political problem, which is that many of the voters, as I said before, whom he needed to persuade that he was more of a typical Democrat, are blue-collar voters, a lot of the people who gravitated toward Hillary Clinton, who are more bread-and-butter, economic-focused Democrats, and they actually like to hear about the minimum wage and some of the other economic proposals that Obama talked about. What I don't think, and I thought that Obama was better on the specifics, and there were more of the specifics than you often have heard from him. What I don't think he did, I thought he left a big opening for McCain, who then failed to seize it, is he didn't connect the change in how government would work and how Washington would work to people's lives. And McCain didn't really either. McCain talked about changing Washington, but he really didn't connect the kind of change he wanted to bring in terms of taking on Jack Abramoff or whatever with how that trickles down on policy terms to ordinary citizens. So it's still a chance for these two candidates to compete on reform.
Let's turn now to Sarah Palin's speech, arguably the most watched and listened, not watched necessarily, but anticipated. It was written by a Bush speechwriter, tailored to her. David, you've been critical of the choice of Sarah Palin. You say it was a cynical ploy, but you say she projected through the speech. What do you mean?
Well, you have to sort of ride the material is just an opportunity for you to give your personality in an airing. This is the fundamental fact of the TV era, right? And there's that old line about Johnny Carson that he was always better than his material. And the material is what allows you to be you. But that's what people are listening for, you, not just the words. And you can see how mechanical this is. I'm not being the first to report this, that the person who's credited with that speech is a former colleague of mine named Matthew Scully. One of the things that I thought was very amusing is Matthew Scully is a vegan, a militant animal rights guy who wrote a beautiful book about the rights of animals, and he's writing speeches for the most famous hunter since Teddy Roosevelt. So politics is a funny business.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and Michael Waldman is executive director of the Brennan Center for Justice. We'll continue our talk about the speeches from the conventions and hear a little bit of Sarah Palin's speech coming up in a moment, here and now. We're talking about speeches at the political conventions with Michael Waldman, executive director of the Brennan Center for Justice, and David Frum, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And let's go now to Sarah Palin's speech and hear a little bit that seemed to resonate with families.
And children with special needs inspire a very, very special love. To the families of special needs children all across this country, I have a message for you. For years, you've sought to make America a more welcoming place for your sons and daughters. And I pledge to you that if we're elected, you will have a friend and advocate in the White House.
As you know, Sarah Palin has a young son with Down syndrome. Michael Waldman, what do you make of that comment in her speech and her speech overall?
That was very appealing, and she projected it well. As David said, she looked very strong looking into the camera and saying that. And what was striking about her was that there was this strength of personality, this almost preternatural self-confidence, given how emphatically she's been plucked out of one life and dropped onto the big stage the way she has. But what was the tone of voice you heard there was the same tone that she used for some of the nastiest personal invective that I've heard from a vice presidential candidate about the other ticket, which she delivered with a smile and poise and sort of a sing-songy voice. And it was very effective. And I will tell you that I am sure that it really energized Republicans. My soundings of people I know, and especially their parents, it has really energized Democrats. There were a lot of older Democrats, from what I can tell, but the polls bear this up, who were for Obama, but a lot of them were very much for Hillary, who ran to give money to Obama in the last 24 hours because, to them, she represents a kind of an extreme religious conservatism that we have not seen on a national ticket before.
Well, let's turn to the Democrats and take a look at Obama's speech. Republicans made rhetoric a bad word going into his speech, and he's known for his soaring rhetoric, and Republicans painted it as empty words. Let's listen to a clip, though, from his speech last week, made on the 45th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech.
Tonight I say to the people of America, to Democrats and Republicans and independents across this great land, enough! This moment, this election is our chance to keep, in the 21st century, the American promise alive.
David, what did you make of Obama's speech?
Well, most people listening to it will remember in their adult lifetime three Democratic presidents: Lyndon Johnson, Jimmy Carter, and Bill Clinton. The first two made an absolute hash of the American economy, leaving behind inflation and rapidly growing government and, in Carter's case, a full-blown credit crisis. The third one, Bill Clinton, started badly but found his footing after he had the unhelpful Democratic congressional majority taken away from him, after he cooperated with Republicans, after he put Bob Rubin in charge of most of his domestic policy and presided over extraordinary prosperity. So I think the listener would say, gee, I want a Clinton-Rubin kind of Democrat, not a Johnson-Carter kind of Democrat. But that speech, that was Johnson-Carter. I mean, where was the statement that we're going to, you know, we're for trade, we're for open markets, we're for competition, we understand, you know, that we discovered something, we learned something in the 90s. I haven't forgotten those lessons, even though I was very critical of President Clinton. You listen, it's all government program, government program, government program.
And not a lot of rhetoric, though.
Well, better more rhetoric than that. I mean, when the policy specifics are dumb, it's better to have soaring rhetoric.
Well, the Republicans have called his speech a mile high and an inch deep. Michael Waldman, do you think that's fair?
No, I don't. I think I don't agree with David's critique entirely, but I think that it accurately reflects more of the speech. I thought that it was as detailed as one gets in a convention speech on policy. And again, Obama did one thing that I thought was terrific, and I thought it was a really good speech. I just didn't think it was something they're going to etch on the walls of the Obama Presidential Library, but that would have been a mistake to give that speech. He got up and gave a robust, articulated defense of liberalism and of his vision of the role of government that was far more unapologetic than Democrats have done in recent years. And as much as I worked with and really admire Bob Rubin and his economics, even Bob Rubin, I think, will tell you this is a different time than the 1990s. So I think that it's important that Obama talked about fiscal discipline and things like that. But I thought that he very consciously chose to give a more robustly progressive speech than Democrats have given lately. And I think that was both refreshing to hear some actual political philosophy from a candidate, and I think it was probably the right choice. I think, though, that there's a block of disaffected Republicans or independents who would have been interested to hear some of the things like what David was saying. I think those voters are still out there. I don't think McCain close the deal with them. I think Palin could, or she could, repel them. I think the Democrats still have more to do to get them.
And to finish up, we're going to look at some of the clever twists we also heard in these speeches. Here's Bill Clinton and Republican VP nominee Sarah Palin.
People the world over have always been more impressed by the power of our example than by the example of our power.
There are some candidates who use change to promote their careers. And then there are those, like John McCain, who use their careers to promote change.
It shows the power of the turn of a phrase. So just briefly, David Frum, what are you going to remember from these convention speeches?
Well, from Sarah Palin's, I think I'll remember her presence rather than from any particular phrase, that special confidence. From Barack Obama's, I'm going to take away this is a marker for his presidency. If this is how he's going to govern, he's heading for a lot of trouble.
And Michael Waldman?
I think Obama did it all. I think that this was a presidential speech of a strong figure. I think Palin is somebody who's going to be on the national stage for years. And I kind of remember that McCain gave a speech, too, but don't ask me what he said.
Michael Waldman is executive director of the Brennan Center for Justice and a former speechwriter for Bill Clinton. David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a former speechwriter for George W. Bush. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now. Students across the country are finishing up their first week back to school today. But for many recent college grads, they're adjusting to not having class or a job. More than a million students graduated from college this past spring, but the number of grads looking for jobs is estimated to exceed the number of available jobs by 25% this year. This as grads, like the rest of us, face high food and fuel prices during an economic slump. D.A. Hayden is co-author of From BA to Payday, Launching Your Career After College. She's also co-founder of the Boston-based career counseling firm Hayden Wilder. Welcome.
Thank you.
And D.A., the U.S. Census Bureau reports that people with a bachelor's degree earn over 60% more on average than those with only a high school diploma, but that probably isn't much consolation to those college grads that have spent the summer unsuccessfully searching for a job.
Well, it's difficult for the ones who have been looking for a job, and it's also very difficult for the ones who have had great summer jobs teaching tennis or lifeguarding, and now all of a sudden it's September and reality hits, and they don't want to live at home anymore.
And how many of them are living at home?
Our statistics tell us that 57% of recent college grads move home after graduation.
And why? Why are they living at home?
Well, they're living at home for a number of reasons. One is the market is down. I mean, there's no question about it. The National Association of Colleges and Employers is telling us that entry-level jobs this year are down by 10%. The other reason is so many of the young people who are graduating today look at their graduation from college as a great goal. And what they really need to think about is it's a starting point.
Well, you also talk about attitude, arrogance, and you call these grads the entitlement generation. Some feel like they've got this big degree from this important college and they just deserve this job. But it's pretty harsh to call them the entitlement generation. What do you mean by that?
Well, they're the entitlement generation, and that's really not a new term. It refers to the fact that this is a generation that has been coddled and cajoled and rewarded and given tremendous accolades for everything they do from breathing to passing a course. And they graduate from college, their parents aren't there anymore, and they really face a state of paralysis.
Well, what about college career services?
Career services are a tremendous resource, but career services are stretched. Their business is to help guide some of these graduates, but certainly not to guarantee to get them jobs. And that's a real misnomer that parents have. They think they've spent all this money on an education, so I should be guaranteed that that child gets a job.
So they come out with this stellar degree, and they try to enter the workforce. And what are some of the common mistakes they're making in this generation?
Probably the most important thing for recent grads to recognize is that it's not really about what you want to do. It's about what you'll get paid to do. So, I mean,
that's a harsh lesson to learn first right out of school.
It's a harsh lesson, but it's facing reality. And once you realize that, then you can start getting a little focus in what it is that you want to do.
And what about some of the common mistakes they may make in the actual interview itself?
Hiring managers are telling us that the number one mistake that these candidates are making is that they don't do sufficient research on the company they're talking to. And we find that if you're not able to speak conversantly and clearly about what it is that that company does, it's really hard to move forward and be enthusiastic in an interview.
And what about etiquette? The old adage is you wear a nice suit and you make a good impression, but what do you suggest to do outside of the interview? Because so much of your personality these days is built online as well.
Well, the first thing you need to do is clean up your Facebook profile and any of the social networking sites. I mean, either get off them completely or be sure that it's absolutely antiseptic. The other thing is your cell phone messages, the address you have for your email. I mean, the majority of employers now search their entry-level candidates on Facebook.
Wow. Well, we've talked on this show about helicopter parents, parents that are overly involved in their kids' lives. They hover, they interfere, and you see this during the job process as well. In fact, you call them Blackhawks.
These are the parents who want to accompany their child to an interview, who want to call the company and negotiate that first salary, who advise their children and write their children's resumes. I mean, that's really a little too much, and that's why we call them Blackhawks.
And how does the helicopter parenting affect your long-term prospects for getting a job and for doing well on a job?
Helicopter parenting is something that is a result of parents really wanting their kids to do well. It's done out of love, but what happens is it really is difficult then for these kids to make decisions, to stand up on their own. Everything that they've done has been molded by their parents and not by themselves as an individual.
D.A. Hayden is co-author of From BA to Payday, Launching Your Career After College. She's also co-founder of the Boston-based career counseling firm Hayden Wilder. Thanks for joining us, D.A.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, now we turn to Chris Gelnow. He graduated from Boston College this past May, and he's been looking for a job since. He recently enrolled in the Hayden Wilder Career Counseling Program, and he's been going to informational interviews and waiting to hear back about a few open positions. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Well, Chris, you majored in communications at Boston College, and what made you choose that major? What did you see yourself doing after college?
To be honest with you, I had no idea what I wanted to do after college. I came in thinking that whatever I did afterwards, I would need to know how to communicate well and write well. So those were kind of my main objectives going in.
When did you start to realize, okay, I've got this degree, but what's my career and how do I start it?
The middle of senior year, probably, when everyone else was kind of starting to get jobs lined up for the fall, I realized that I didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do and where to start.
How has the career counseling helped you focus your job search?
It has helped a lot, actually. Kind of coming right out, just doing a couple interviews, I kind of realized that I had no idea what I was doing in interviews, making a lot of the typical mistakes.
What was one of the mistakes you made?
Probably the primary mistake was not getting across what I wanted to get across in interviews, and a lot of time kind of rambling and saying things that maybe I might say to my friends but are certainly not appropriate for interviews.
And what have your friends' experiences been like? You know, have their job searches been going better or about the same?
Of my roommates, about half were arts and sciences majors, and the other half were business majors. The business majors all kind of knew what they wanted to do coming out and had jobs lined up, whereas my friends who were kind of in the same boat as I was have been on similar paths. One of my friends actually ended up taking a job in Singapore because he couldn't find anything that he really liked here.
Now, D.A. Hayden, we just heard, talked about your generation as being the entitlement generation. You've had parents maybe who've hovered over you with every decision that you've made, and too many people told you that your work is great and you're going to do great things. And now you're still looking for a job several months after graduation.
Yeah, I think the criticism is certainly true, for, at least in my experience. Especially having grown up through high school and college, there's always an immediate goal in the future, whether it's either through sports or getting good grades so you can get into a good college, and then in college just getting good grades. And then it's kind of you've been guided your entire life and told you're the greatest and for the most part receive okay grades. And then it's kind of like you're just let out into the wild without a clue, really. And I definitely experienced that kind of harsh transition and took a while to get used to, you know, not every interviewer is going to love you, not every person is going to love you, and it's definitely a new experience for me, building thicker skin.
Well, good luck with your job search.
Thank you.
That's Chris Gelnow. He graduated from Boston College this past May, and he's looking for a job. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. Let's take a break from politics now and talk about sports. Pro football is back. The NFL season kicked off last night with the defending Super Bowl champion New York Giants shutting down the Washington Redskins 16-7. Last year's Super Bowl runner-ups, the New England Patriots, begin their season Sunday afternoon against the Kansas City Chiefs. Here to talk about that and the rest of the busy September sports scene is our very own Maverick sports guy, Bill Littlefield, host of the NPR program Only a Game.
It's a popular adjective these days, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
All right.
Well, the Giants got off to a good start last night. Can they repeat as Super Bowl champs?
Well, they beat the racial slurs, and that was, in fact, a good start. But I don't think the Giants can repeat because it's very hard to play football with a 27-pound championship ring on your hand. It's a terrific disadvantage, and I don't think they can overcome it.
Well, what about the Patriots? They don't have that ring because they had a crushing
they missed
loss.
It by one game.
Yes, they did.
Well, the Patriots have a starting quarterback who has yet to play this season, and that usually is not a good sign, although they say Tom Brady is fine and healthy. They do lack a certain motivation. They were motivated last year by the fact that everybody else in the league was accusing them of cheating, and that's terrific motivation, and that's no longer there. So that's kind of too bad, but we'll see what they can do.
Anything else you're going to be looking for in pro football?
It's very hard not to pay attention to the Jets this year, I think, because Brett Favre, who was the quarterback for Green Bay for such a long time for the Packers, retired and is now unretired, and he's not only the starting quarterback for the Jets, he's the captain. The Jets had so little imagination that they elected him captain, even though he's been in camp for less time than anybody else, which is kind of comical. I don't know how long it'll be before he retires again, but heck, I wish him the best.
Well, a big upset in college football last night. Unranked Vanderbilt beat number 24 South Carolina 24-17. Should we expect more upsets like that?
I guess we should expect more upsets like that in the SEC. People who know a great deal more about college football than I do assure me that it's a great conference full of wonderful teams. And when you have a great conference full of wonderful teams, sometimes the slightly less wonderful team beats the one that you thought was more wonderful, and they call it an upset. So that may happen a good deal in that conference this year.
Moving on to baseball, it's last month of the regular season. Of course, we're all in Boston, so we care about the Red Sox. They're 3.5 games behind the Tampa Bay Rays in the American League East. Can they catch the Rays?
I think they can. Of course, they can catch the Rays. I mean, anything can happen. The Red Sox get hot, the Rays get cold. But I got to kind of hope that Tampa holds on, because there's never been a team that's finished last in every previous season of its existence except one, where they finished next to last. And all of a sudden, they're first, and they've been first for a long time, and they've been first even with their best players on the bench with injuries and everything else. I got to kind of hope it's the Rays and the Cubs in the World Series, don't you think?
Well, that is another underdog I was going to ask about. Is it finally the year for the Cubs?
Perfect symmetry, 100 years since the Cubs last won the World Series. So I got to think this is the year.
On another baseball note, they're using replays now to decide home run calls. Has that affected any games yet?
It affected one game, and wouldn't you know it, it was a game involving the Yankees and Alex Rodriguez. He hit a home run. The Rays thought it wasn't a home run. The replay showed that it was a home run, and Alex Rodriguez said, yeah, well, there's going to be a controversy. It's 2-1 in favor of my being involved in it. So at least he has a sense of humor, and that's fine.
Tennis, U.S. Open women's semifinal matches today, men's semis tomorrow. Tell me a little bit about this spat between two of the men who played each other in the quarterfinals.
Well, you know, in tennis, as in golf, spat is fairly broadly defined. If somebody says something somewhat uncomplimentary about another player, it qualifies as a spat. In hockey, a spat is when somebody hits the other guy over the head with a stick. That so rarely happens in tennis. I mean, it's not going to amount to a whole lot, I think. And I think the U.S. Open will come down to Federer and Nadal, as it frequently does. Unhappily, in the women's side, it will not come down to Williams v. Williams, because they played that match in the quarterfinals. So whoever made up the draw should rethink their theory about that.
And before we go, what should we look at the Paralympics getting underway in Beijing?
We can look at a local guy, Anderson Wise, a power lifter born with spina bifida. He'll be competing in Beijing, and we'll be profiling him on Only a Game.
That's Only a Game host Bill Littlefield. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
And stay with us after the break, because we'll be queuing up the music that played during the political conventions. Our critic says the choices didn't always make sense. That's coming up here and now.
The
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov. It's Here and Now. Hail to the Chief. That's the song that both Barack Obama and John McCain are hoping will one day herald their arrivals. But until then, both presidential campaigns are scanning their iPods to co-opt songs that best symbolize their runs for the White House. In a world where public opinion means everything, how important is the music of a political campaign? Here and Now's pop culture guru, Renee Graham, has been monitoring the sounds of the party conventions over the last 2 weeks, and she joins us with more. Welcome, Renee.
Hi, Monica.
Renee, let's start with the Democrats. What was the main theme of the music at the DNC last week?
The music was all what I call comfort food. Lots of vintage soul, lots of R&B, lots of Motown, you know, James Brown music, Aretha Franklin's Respect, Get Ready by the Temptations, Martha Reeves and the Vandellas, music that everyone is really familiar with.
And maybe that culminated in what was played right after Barack Obama spoke, Love Train.
It was really the theme. You know, Love Train's all about unity, we are together, and that's what the Democrats were really trying to do last week, to present this united front. And I guess in their minds, what better way to do that in this song that's so about just love and togetherness and unity?
Well, Renee, what were some of the more unusual musical moments?
Well, there were moments that made good sense, and others that were just pure head-scratchers. Miami Mayor Manuel Diaz came out to Vicky Sue Robinson's Turn the Beat Around, a wonderful old disco chestnut, but what that had to do with the Miami mayor, I'm really, really not sure. You had Jay Rockefeller, the senator from West Virginia, coming out to Midnight Train to Georgia. Again, a great song, but he's from West Virginia. Why wouldn't you play John Denver's Take Me Home, Country Roads, which first line talks about West Virginia? Very strange moments there.
And what about the song that played right after Michelle Obama spoke?
Played Stevie Wonder's Isn't She Lovely, which, you know, served two purposes. One, Stevie Wonder is one of her favorite musicians, and the other, you know, the idea that Michelle Obama, isn't she lovely? Of course, the strange thing is the song was actually written by Stevie Wonder for his newborn daughter, which seems kind of odd to sing, play for a grown woman, but I think the whole idea behind these things is that people are more connecting to the song than it's not necessarily the lyrics of the song.
So the lyrics don't always connect with what's happening at the convention.
Not at all, and they don't even necessarily connect with what it is that the candidate wants to convey. The Obama campaign has often used U2's song City of Blinding Lights, which sounds really celebratory and uplifting, but the first line of the song is,
the more you see, the less you know.
Not a message they want to send.
Not a message they want to send, but I think the music is selected with the idea that people don't really pay attention to the words anyway. So you get songs that have a certain uplift, but the words mean something entirely different once you read them or listen to them.
Well, on the last night of the DNC at Invesco Field in Denver, it had the feel of a rock concert with several musical guests playing live. And tell me about some of the highlights there.
Oh, it was a DNC Lollapalooza. There was a certain point you forgot that this was supposed to be about Barack Obama giving his accepting the nomination. You had John Legend performing with Will.i.am, the song that Will.i.am from the Black Eyed Peas wrote, Yes, We Can.
Put your hands up if you think we can.
Yes, we can.
If you believe we can, put your hands
up.
Yes, we can.
Yes, we can. Only in America, dreaming in red, white, and blue.
And after Barack Obama accepted the nomination and gave his speech, they played Only in America, a country song.
A song by Brooks and Dunn. It was really interesting. It was pretty much the only country song played during the DNC. And I think it's to make this statement, you know, I'm middle America, I'm just like you. And also the idea that, you know, my story can only happen in this wonderful country. So I think that's what he was trying to say. And to take away that audience, you know, a little bit from John McCain.
Yeah, because John McCain has positioned himself as country first. And do you see a bit of a tug of war going on here between the two parties, in addition to everything else they disagree over music?
Oh, I think the music is very important in that same kind of way. You're trying to brand yourself.
And at the Republican convention, we heard Johnny B. Goode.
John McCain, Johnny B. Goode. It was obvious. It was wonderful. You know, it's a great song. You know, it has nothing to do with McCain's background because, of course, the song is about this poor kid. It's actually autobiographical for the singer, Chuck Berry, which is this poor kid working his way out through his music. And that's really not John McCain's story at all. But Johnny B. Good, John McCain, that's close enough for most people. So there it was. And people seem to be having a really good time to it. Generally speaking, in comparison to the DNC, there just wasn't that much music. There were just lots of moments where people were standing and talking. Every now and then you would hear some kind of, you know, smooth jazz in the background or some sort of some country song, but generally not nearly as much music. Speakers weren't coming out to songs, although every now and then you would hear some song like Journey's Don't Stop Believing.
Don't stop believing.
Which I'm sure on one hand, you know, evokes the idea, you know, the Republicans don't stop believing in us, but also evokes The Sopranos final episode. So go figure.
And right before President Bush spoke, not necessarily leading into him, there was another song played that was maybe a head-scratcher.
Right. Necessarily, I don't see there was any connection necessarily to President Bush, but they played AC/DC's Thunderstruck.
Renee, this is hard rock. That's a little out of control for a convention. A lot of people are, middle-aged and elderly at this party.
And it's a much more conservative crowd. And I kept thinking, well, AC/DC, they're this Australian band. I thought, you know, I don't know that they have any political affiliation with either party. But, you know, there it was. You know, Brian and Angus just wailing away. What it had to do with anything going on at the convention, I have no idea. And a lot of people in the audience looked really perplexed.
Well, how important is music at these events anyway?
I think the music has become increasingly important. It's all about setting a mood. In a lot of ways, it's a subliminal message. It's like those slogans or American flags that are behind candidates when they give political speeches. It's supposed to tell you something about who the person is and what they represent. John Rich performed an original song he wrote for John McCain called Raising McCain, which has become an anthem that McCain has used from time to time. And so there was no way he wasn't going to perform at the RNC because the song has gotten a lot of attention.
Well, so if you could advise the political campaigns on songs they should go for, what would you suggest?
You know, I mean, there was a lot of complaint the last 2 weeks about the music being really dated and boring. And I don't know what people expect. They're not going to play, you know, Lil Wayne and Vampire Weekend. It's about safe choices. You know, Barack Obama might say he's a Jay-Z fan, but you're not going to see Jay-Z performing at the convention. It's just going to upset too many people. So it's all about safe. I think the music is fine because, you know, it could all be kind of dry and boring otherwise, and you get to see a lot of really bad dancing. So I think the music is great. I think keep the music coming and just make it interesting. You know, don't go for the most obvious choices. I'd be perfectly happy to see a convention with no Motown whatsoever.
Well, thank you very much, Renee.
Thanks, Monica.
Here and now is pop culture guru expert Renee Graham on the music at the party conventions over the last couple of weeks. And one last musical note, the 1977 hit Barracuda was played over the sound system as John McCain and Sarah Palin greeted the crowd together last night. Sarah Barracuda is the nickname Palin received in high school for the intensity of her play on the basketball court. Well, the Wilson sisters of the band Heart, who recorded Barracuda, have asked the McCain campaign not to use their music. In a statement, they say they condemn the use of their song at the Republican convention. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov. Robin Young returns on Monday. Have a great weekend. And please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.